Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Well, you may read the New York Times columns by Gail Collins and David Brooks, but perhaps you don't know that they publish an online dialogue between them on the New York Times website most every Wednesday. It's called The Conversation. David and Gail have been good enough to bring some of that conversation onto this program several times in the past, and they are back right now at this historic but inflamed moment as the House is heading for a likely health reform vote on Sunday. I'm not sure which of them needs a larger dose of Xanax to get through the weekend, Gail or David. But Gail, David, thanks a lot for doing this again, and welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks.
Good to be with you.
David, let's start here. Your column last Friday praised President Obama, but dissed the country. You wrote that in a sensible country, people would see Obama as trying to define a modern brand of moderate progressivism, but we don't live in that country, you wrote. What country do we live in?
A 180-degree country. My point was that in a normal country, people more or less on the right, like me, would see Obama, sort of we disagree with him, maybe 40 degrees. But in this country, all disagreement has to be 180 degrees. And so that it's just easier to raise money. It makes you feel better when you think the other side is completely wrong. And you can write with more force and vigor and power. You get to ignore, say, a third of the evidence that's out there. And so we have developed the habits of maximum disagreement all the time.
Is it a broken country for that?
Well, I think that's part of the reason it's a broken country. I think, I could go down the list of my current panoply of depressions.
David, you are so sad. I should not have gone on vacation. You have just gotten so miserable while I was gone.
I know. I think that's why you left me alone. And now, you know, they've taken away all sharp objects. I get crayons here at the asylum. And I watch test patterns.
But wait a minute, Gail. You think things are really so much better than he describes?
Well, I take a longer view, I think. It's the fact of history in America is that whenever you have a period where there's a lot of media and it's undercapitalized to a great extent, so that basically you have a lot of people who can go into the media business rather easily, but they have to somehow figure out how to get attention. You have a really shrill political discourse. That's what happened sort of at the turn between the 19th and 20th century, when every town had 10 or 15 little newspapers running around, and they were all crazy. And I keep telling David, Grover Cleveland went through this, you know, and we survived. It'll be okay. We just have to adapt a little bit and, you know, ride it out.
I sort of halfway agree with that. On the other hand, you know, New York used to have, you know, maybe a dozen newspapers, and we had people like Walter Lippmann, great big ponderous columnists. I'm not sure I completely agree with it. And the other thing I'd say is I think we've gone beyond the media landscape. I mean, if you look at what's happening Capitol Hill over the last few days, this is where I go completely around the bend, but the talking about passing this health care legislation by this technique called demon pass, where you don't actually vote for it, you just vote for the amendment to it and you deem it to have been passed, and using reconciliation in the Senate, these are signs beyond the media landscape, deep into the political landscape, that there's actually no functioning system working.
David, you're the only person I know who can become suicidal over parliamentary procedure.
Well, David, can you go a little deeper on your characterization of Obamaism, this modern brand of moderate progressivism? Can you talk about where the center of that is in terms of values or policies as you see it?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, obviously he's a believer in government activism, and he is a man of the left. But whenever you talk to him or whenever you listen to his speeches starting back in Iowa and up until, you know, any day of last week, he does have a sentence structure which is always balanced. It's always on the one hand, on the other. If you read his book, I'm forgetting the name of his second book, you found this sentence structure time and time again. So it's always, we've got to regulate the market, but try to keep it vibrant and dynamic. It's always on the one hand, on the other. And even health care, listen, on balance, I'm against the health care bill. But it's not single payer. It's not what Howard Dean wanted. It's a program that looks a little like what Mitt Romney put together with Ted Kennedy in Massachusetts, what Bob Dole and Tom Daschle agreed to in a bipartisan commission. It's not, and he has not certainly not governed as a liberal dream president. And so I just tried to make that point. He's a moderate centrist who's willing to take on, say, the teacher unions for some pretty sacred causes in the Democratic Party. And so he's a man of the left, but he's not a man of any extreme by any means.
And, Gail, you wrote, the problem right now isn't a lack of bipartisanship. It's a lack of ability by the people who got elected to deliver and then be judged on the results. What do you mean by lack of ability to be judged on the results? Isn't that what the midterm elections will be?
No, I think first you've got to be able to deliver. You can't be judged on the results when it's impossible to produce any results. And the Senate, and this is really all about the Senate has evolved itself in a very strange way that kind of takes advantage of all the changes that have happened in communication, but does it in a way to sort of stop things from happening, so that really you can do absolutely nothing that's in any way, shape, or form even slightly difficult with the U.S. Senate, as long as the Senate has to have 60 votes for everything, and the Republicans have worked up themselves up into a strategy in which you basically have to make sure that Obama fails no matter what. And all those things together, plus the fact that in the Senate you have people representing states that do not have as many people as my neighborhood. So the place is already tilted toward conservative outcomes just because you have so many kind of small, empty states with so much power. And you put all those things together, and you've got a place that just, you know, is only geared up towards stopping things. And I don't think that's, you know, a crisis in our national civility. I think it's that the Senate has not moved ahead in its rules and procedures to reflect the new world we live in. You've got to be able, if you run in this highly politicized, charged environment, when you promise to do things, be able to at least deliver on one or two of them when you have huge majorities in both parts of the legislature. So, and then you can throw everybody out. And then if people don't like it, you can throw everybody out and take them back the next year.
So David, what about that? I mean, maybe the filibuster as an institution, and even the way the Senate is structured so that there's overrepresentation of what Gail called these small, empty conservative states, maybe that's worse procedurally than Demon Pass or reconciliation.
Yeah, I guess I don't think so. I like small, empty states. I tend to vacation in them. The first thing to be said is we actually have not had a period of policy stagnation over the last 10 or 20 years. We've passed plenty of big bills, from No Child Left Behind to various tax cuts to prescription drug, all sorts of things, usually with when the Republicans were in charge with 10 or 12 Democratic senators. So I think we've had a fair amount of actual action. I guess the reason health care is hard to pass is because it's always hard to pass unpopular pieces of legislation. I mean, for most of the last 5 months, you had about 55% of the American people saying they opposed it, 38% saying they supported it. Now it's down, so that now the gap is probably about 7 or 8 points, not 13 or 14. It's gotten a little less unpopular, but it's still pretty unpopular. And so it's hard to pass this bill out of the House, only with Democratic votes. So it's not a question of parliamentary procedure why it's hard to pass this bill. It's just unpopular in the country after a year of pretty full debate.
New York Times columnists David Brooks and Gail Collins are my guests on WNYC. They have an online conversation on the New York Times website on Wednesdays, and they're bringing some of that onto the air right now. Gail, on that point, the Democrats are increasingly heard to say, I think, that this is an unpopular bill because it's been lied about and distorted by the Republicans and their allies in the conservative part of the media. Do you take that position?
I do, but I think it's a larger point. It's unpopular because it's been distorted by the Republicans, because that's the way things operate now politically, and I'm totally willing to adjust to that. We're basically moving into a much more kind of parliamentary era, I think, in which you've got two parties and you fight and you demonize each other all day long, and you guys stick together and then you pass the bill or don't pass the bill. But you've got to be, I keep coming back to them, we have not really passed much serious legislation over the last, Bill Clinton got you know, one tiny tax increase that destroyed the lives of, you know, half the people who voted for it, and that was sort of it for him. George W. Bush did get the Medicare drug bill, but he didn't pay for it. It doesn't seem to me to count if you can get a big spending bill that you don't pay for in any way, shape, or form. Basically, all you can do these days is tax people, reduce taxes, or go to war. Anything else gets kind of caught up in this, you know, the jaws of this crazy system that we have right now. But I don't think it's because the country has gone nuts or lost its civility. I just think communication has changed. That's changed politics, and we have to adapt the system to reflect that. You have to be able to let these people go and do something. You cannot expect the American people to keep track of the pluses and minuses of a 2-trillion-page health care bill. They just have to sit back and let them do it and then judge the results.
David, willful distortion and a public vulnerable to the lies?
Well, it became unpopular not because Republicans were against it. Republicans were always against it. It was the independents who moved. And the independents moved not because suddenly Mitch McConnell became a brilliant communicator or John Boehner became the smartest man on the planet. They moved because there's no persuasive cost control. And, you know, we're adding already $9.8 trillion to the deficit. This bill by the Medicare actuary will not decrease the rate of health care inflation. So while our competitors are spending 10% of their GDPs or 11% on healthcare, we'll be spending 20-25%. And so I think there are sound reasons why independents opposed it. And I really don't think it was because they all watched Glenn Beck.
The positive scoring by the Congressional Budget Office yesterday didn't bring you closer to yes?
Not really. I mean, listen, this bill does have some serious things. You know, Gail talked about all the things that have not been paid for. Not even close. And that's not true of this. There are some things to make it less fiscally disastrous. Nonetheless, it's moderately fiscally disastrous.
But it produces all really the tools that you need to begin to get this stuff under control.
Well,
given the difficulty that, I mean, all the things that you don't like about the bill, David, are the things that would have made it even more impossible to pass if it had been in the bill. This bill, I would argue, is the most cost-control-y bill that conceivably could be passed, given the fact that the Republican Party shamefully is now running around saying that this bill is going to destroy Medicare, that, you know, terrifying the public, when their own alternative plan completely eliminates Medicare for future generations. I mean, it's a perfectly reasonable bill economically. It's just that the public would go crazy. And they're demonizing this bill for the very reasons that David theoretically should like it, because it really does try to get a handle on costs.
Well, I guess I don't want to defend the Republican positions. I think, and I've written what they said about Medicare and death panels and all that is ridiculous. And I guess I would sign on to Gail's shameful. nonetheless, I mean, let's look at some of the gimmicks that get the positive CBO score. The big one is the excise tax, imagining they're going to pass a $1 trillion tax in 2018 that they don't have the guts to even start.
On the so-called Cadillac plans.
Right. And then there's the Social Security dodge, where they take money out of Social Security to pay for this. Then there's the long-term coverage dodge, where they take money that's being paid into a trust fund as if it was just straight-out revenue they'd never have to pay for. Then there's the doc fix, which is $220 billion based on the supposition they're going to cut doctors' reimbursement by 20%. I mean, all these things are just never going to happen. And the CBO has to score what's on paper. They can't score what's politically realistic. So there are quite a lot of gimmicks in here, which will probably add to the deficit by, you know, billions of dollars, tens of billion dollars every year. So to me, it's not, you know, you ask, you know, we're heading toward a fiscal catastrophe. Does this really solve the problem? And, you know, I guess if you say, well, they couldn't have gotten any better than a bill that's really going to make deficits much worse, well, somebody's got to say, you know, we got to do a little better than this. We can't just march further into catastrophe.
Gail, is there really a reason to trust future Congresses to make these cuts with more guts than the current Congress has?
Well, there's a reason to trust. For instance, we're going to probably get rid of some of the crazed Bush tax cuts this year, not because Congress has gotten braver over the past few years, but because they were forced to put in triggers that make things happen if you don't behave better in the future. I mean, everything, it's true, you know, that this is certainly not the most fiscally clean, tidy, and neat bill in the history of the universe. But it's a bill that begins to get insurance companies under control, that begins to get everybody covered so that you can have kind of one national vision of where healthcare is going as opposed to the crazy system we have right now. It's a bill that has lots and lots of programs that allows Congress to monitor how different kinds of cost control systems work. You know, and I think probably David is right that things are going to get worse economically, and you are going to come up in about 5 or 10 years to a new, bigger crisis on the deficit, on medical spending. But this bill is going to make it easier to solve that than not having this bill.
Gail Collins and David Brooks with us for just another few minutes. And David, before you go, your column today offers a possible way out of the broken politics and even broken culture, according to a British writer named Philip Blond, who's, I gather, kind of a third-way thinker who rails against liberal individualism, which destroys families, and conservative individualism, which allows Walmart to destroy local businesses. Do you think this relates to our broken politics?
Yeah, I mean, I sort of wrote it both to have a degree of optimism and to, you know, keep myself completely out of the funny farm. But, you know, I do think one of the reasons we're in this mess, it's not only, I mean, Miguel's right about the media, obviously, but there's also an ideological rut we've fallen into where we've had two competing individualisms fighting over each other that, I guess, the debate sort of emerged in the 60s. And what Blond is offering, and what people in the communitarian movement in the U.S. and even the Democratic Leadership Council have offered, is a much more communitarian vision. Don't start with the idea of that we're all radical, autonomous individuals the way some economists imagine. Start with the idea that we're all socially connected beings, and ask, what have we done to increase and to enhance community relationships anywhere? And I think you'll find that we've decimated that. And some of that is the fault of the market. You know, Walmart coming in and destroying local shop owners. Some of that is the fault of the welfare state, which has replaced some of the old mutual aid societies. And so what Blond does is he says, let's not think about the individual, let's think about what we're doing with community relationships. And he starts from that community basis. And that, I think, is the sort of idea system that some on the left and some on the right can agree with. And once you get an actual alternative philosophy out there, maybe you can actually repair some of what's happened.
Gail, I wonder about your reaction to this, and I don't expect that you've also necessarily read Philip Blond, though maybe you have, but in the context of your new book, and you knew I'd get the plug in here somehow.
Thank you.
When Everything Changed, The Amazing Journey of American Women from 1960 to the Present, is it possible for half the population to be getting stronger and happier while the whole population is getting more depressed?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. It's actually the opposite with women in some ways. And, you know, there's all these surveys now coming out showing that women are less happy than men. And it always reminds me that there was an old Ellen Goodman column about, you know, how she said in the 80s that, like, all of her female friends were so happy because they had grown up thinking, you know, their male friends had grown up thinking they were going to be president of the United States, and they just wound up being a professor at Harvard. And her female friends grew up thinking they were going to be a receptionist, and they wound up being a professor at Harvard. And now women feel the same strains as men to sort of get everything and achieve everything, and they perhaps do feel more fragile and stuff. But my big argument, I think, with David's big worries and theories about this is that the vision of that wholesome together society that I think he kind of yearns for, you know, which is one of the things I love about him, is that it's based on a very homogeneous kind of society in which everybody who ran things came from the same places and was exactly alike. And there weren't any women involved. There weren't any blacks involved. There weren't any former poor people, for the most part, involved. It's very hard to do all that stuff when everybody is so different.
But is the only alternative, you know, Glenn Beck versus Keith Olbermann?
No, for sure not. And I am taken by the fact that, you know, these Tea Party people who drive me nuts, I must admit, in so many ways, you do get the sense that the good-hearted ones in the group are just so thrilled at the idea of being part of a group and running around, you know, doing stuff and having meetings and feeling that they're accomplishing something. And then there is a real hunger for that, but I don't know that the way to do it is to, you know, to go back to that kind of, 1950s, 60s society in which everybody knew their place.
So, David, I've been watching you move toward precise percentages in your predictions of political outcomes lately. So my last question to you is, are the odds of health reform passing on Sunday greater or worse than the odds of Murray State making it to the Final Four?
That's an easy one. They're greater. I think they're even greater than Duke. So I think they're better than 50-50.
Gail, do you play the numbers?
I don't do the basketball ones. My team already lost. So, but I think they're going to do this. And if they do, it's going to be huge. I mean, we have to stop looking always at the bad side of these things. This is going to be a huge and huge achievement. We're going to cover everybody for health care. My God in heaven, that's big. Be happy.
Besides reading Gail Collins and David Brooks in the New York Times, you can read their weekly conversations on the Times website. The new ones go up every Wednesday, and Gail's new book is When Everything Changed, The Amazing Journey of American Women from 1960 to the Present. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up in just a minute, you know, it's not just health reform that's going to be big in Washington over this weekend. It's also going to be immigration. There's going to be a huge pro-immigration rally, and in a minute we'll talk to somebody who is walking from New York to Washington to attend that rally. But first, it's not just Friday. It's Follow-Up Friday, where we dig a little deeper into something that came up briefly earlier in the week. Yesterday, while I was talking to Washington Post and Newsweek columnist Ezra Klein about health reform, a listener, Jamie, called in to question something that President Obama said this week in Ohio. Here's a bit of that exchange from yesterday's show.
The president in his speech, I believe his last speech, was it in Ohio? He said the premiums for employers on their insurance policies would drop 3,000%. And I'm an employer, and I'd like to know how that's possible.
Well, first of all, nothing can drop more than 100% because then it's at zero. So the president must have said something else. But do you know, Ezra, what he might be referring to?
I don't know. As you say, that would be a mathematical impossibility.
So we couldn't confirm during the show yesterday whether President Obama said that thing about 3,000%, but we checked it out later and found that he did indeed say that with a health care overhaul, insurance premiums could fall by as much as 3,000% for small businesses. Here's that clip.
Your employer, it's estimated, would see premiums fall by as much as 3,000%, which means they could give you a raise.
However, a White House press spokesperson said later that the president misspoke. He meant to say that the premiums would go down $3,000. Big difference. Some people dispute the $3,000 figure, by the way, as well, but that's a whole other segment. At least it's good to know that the White House doesn't actually think something can go down by 3,000%. So I hope that clarifies that. A little follow-up Friday segment. We'll come back and talk about the immigration march with somebody who is actually walking from New York to Washington to attend. And then we'll hear from an advocate for illegal immigrants who want them to boycott the census rather than fill out their forms. Stay with us.